Hello, this is Persephone 33, and this is the June Fire and Ice podcast. I'll tell you what, ladies, this month, the Angst Fest of Doom, bracketed, of course, it almost sent me around the twist. If I weren't such a glass half full kind of a girl, I might have just ended it all, but worry not. I sallied forth and got through it all. I should quote Maranthridale Bloom by saying that this podcast neither begins, passes through, nor ends in a happy place. This is the anti-fluff, so be forewarned. That said, next month we are going to do happy, funny, fluffy, sweet fix. I mean, the sweeter the better. I'm totally ready for it. So submit those to the suggestive fic thread on the forums. I should tell you that I have a little help this month. Alicia will be doing a top 10 list and the announcements for the months of June. After Alicia, I'm going to record A Bed Made for One, by Saria Okalani, which has no warnings except for, of course, angst. So you're safe in listening to that. But after that starts the warnings, the non-consensual sex, violence, character death, language, really, really horrible things. So if you're not comfortable with listening to that after A Bed Made for One, you just need to turn off your iPod or your computer or whatever you're listening to and get ready for next month's happy stuff. So that said, enjoy yourselves and I'll see you next month.
Hey, I'm Alicia and this is June's DG Top 10. The top 10 reasons why Draco loves Ginny. 10. She makes Greek salad with olives for him, even though she's previously declared them a crime against taste buds. 9. She knows how to make him laugh and is only one of 3 people that have seen it. 8. She has a fantastic rack. 7. She may have been scared of Lucius, but never showed it. 6. She doesn't fancy the Weird Sisters lead singer. She's much more individual. She fancies the bass player. 5. She fits perfectly in his lap for cuddling. 4. She can drink him under the table and hence controls the keys to his liquor cabinet. 3. As much as she loves flying with him even more. 2. She learned how to prank from her brothers. And the number one reason that Draco loves Ginny is she knows how to make his coffee. Thanks to Maranthridale Bloom for another great top 10 list. Announcements for the month of June, well, the whole summer really, are these. The DG Fig Exchange wrapped up last week, and all authors should have turned in their stories by now, so head on over to the Exchange on LiveJournal to read lots of great fics right now. Crawl to Parchment, a new fanfiction award site, is taking nominations for all genres and pairings until June 4th, so go nominate your favourites. July? Do we even need to say it? Deathly Hallows comes out on the 21st, and the Order of the Phoenix movie comes out on the 13th, so there's at least a couple of days worth of entertainment right there. The Harry Potter Prophecy Conference takes place August 3rd to 5th. Everyone that lives close, go and take pictures and then tell us all about it. And now, back to the Angst Fest of Doom.
Here are the birthdays for the month of June. On June 1st, Ping Pong 0601 celebrates a birthday. On the 5th, Cole Blue Blood shares a birthday with Draco Malfoy, and we're all, I'm sure, very jealous of her. The 13th of June is Di Lorelei's birthday. Happy birthday, DL. On June 15th, Oxymoron 8 celebrates a birthday. And on the 18th of June, our beloved Sight Mummy celebrates her birthday. So happy birthday, Minuet, and all the other ladies celebrating their birthdays in June. The top 10 signs you're a DG angst fangirl. Number 10, your beta is worried about your mental health. Number 9, your real life friends don't know the depths of your depravity and it's staying that way. And number 8, you've allowed Ginny a token struggle and then cackled as she is completely overpowered. Number 7, you know what a Chinese wedding bed is. Number 6, you've waxed lyrical about how beautiful Ginny is when she's frightened, disturbed, or bleeding. Number 5, you keep tissues next to you when you read fic. Number 4, you advocate the use of unforgivable curses for Draco to get what he wants. Number 3, your favorites list consists of fics that would make strong men whimper and cry. Number 2, you harbor a secret desire to write a DG Labyrinth crossover fic just so Draco can deliver Jareth's line, "Let me rule you, love me, fear me. Do as I say and I will be your slave." And number 1 of the top 10 signs you're a DG angst fangirl is you've stated that redemption is far too overrated. A Bed Made for One by Saria Okolani. We find them in a room not much larger than a prison cell, curled together in a bed made for one. A single candle gutters in and out, casting just enough light for us to see that the room is sparsely furnished and has no windows. We aren't sure at first what we're seeing. Maybe we're here to learn that there isn't always a just-in-time, that in life, just-in-time is balanced all too often by too late. It's a difficult lesson to retain. The brain can't process what the heart, deafened by hope, will not hear. For a moment, I can feel the breath in my lungs compress in fear, in horror, in regret, in relief, and I know that my companions are feeling the same thing. It's been a long journey, and seeing the familiar red-gold hair that spreads over the pillow like blood and half obscures the face of the other occupant in the bed, we know that one way or another, closure has found us tonight. I can feel Ron shaking beside me, so I approach the bed first. It has to be me if it's not him. I'm her surrogate brother, after all. It wouldn't be right for any of the others to assume this duty. As I get closer and still don't sense movement, I start to think how I will tell Ron, her parents, the rest of her family. But the figures in the bed aren't dead, only sleeping. At least I can see the blanket shift as they breathe. The girl slumbers half on the bed, half on her companion, wearing a faded pink shirt that has seen better days. I can see enough to know that the other person is male. Unlike Jenny, he's not clothed, at least from the waist up. The only thing that decorates his skin is her crimson hair, which falls everywhere. His face is in shadow and partially obscured by her fiery locks. The thought runs through my mind that most would find all the hair bothersome, brush strands away in sleep perhaps, in an unconscious attempt for relief. But he doesn't, and hasn't. I reach out to touch her arm gently. She makes a sound of distress as my skin makes contact with hers, and I wonder if it's the roughness of my hands that makes her recoil. She feels alive and warm under my fingertips, and I expel the breath I didn't know I was holding. Next to me, Ron does the same. "Jenny," I say, "Jenny, wake up, it's me, ha—" A hand with long, hard fingers grasps my wrist. Startled, I drop to my knees to relieve the pressure and stare wide-eyed at the other occupant of the bed, the last person in the world I expected to see. He doesn't seem to recognize me as he rasps, "Don't touch her." But his eyes are like steel. "What are you doing here?" It's the only thing I can think of to say, though immediately after I can think of 1,000 questions to ask about the people who've kept them here, the information could be significant. His expression doesn't change, but now Ron and the others are demanding that he let me go. Only when Jenny has been hauled out of the bed by her brother does Draco Malfoy let up on my wrist. I pull away, but he doesn't seem to notice anymore. Ron holds Jenny by the waist, and his stunned expression probably matches mine when he correctly identifies his sister's bed companion. "You," is all he says. But Malfoy isn't looking at him. He's looking at the girl in Ron's arms. Her body feels like a doll's next to mine, frail and malleable, the bones too prominent and poking me through her clothes. I'm surprised that she hasn't already collapsed under the weight of relief that's been bombarded on her from all sides. But then if her presence here proves anything, it's that Jenny is stronger than she looks. I think I feel the ghosts of her hands on my back, but when I pull away, her arms are at her sides. She hasn't said a word since she arrived. And even when her mother wept all over her, Jenny's eyes remained dry. She is so thin, the robes she wears hang on her like a little girl in her mother's clothes. We're all thin now, food being a carefully rationed commodity, but she is especially so. I imagine her captors had a difficult enough time keeping themselves fed, much less their prisoners. Her skin, which has always been pale, seems nearly translucent now. The freckles faded to the point of non-existence. It's been a long time since she's seen the sun. This and the blue-purple shadows under her eyes lend a peculiar quality she's never possessed before. In fact, Jenny looks more beautiful than I've ever seen her. But I feel so guilty for this thought when it's the result of her captivity that I look away. It's only then that I notice they brought someone else with her. The shock of seeing Draco Malfoy in our foyer has me stepping back, reaching for my wand before the rational part of my brain realizes that Harry and the rest of the rescue team are completely at ease, removing their cloaks and talking quietly amongst themselves. No one sees my reaction except for Malfoy and possibly Jenny, but she's looking around as if she's never seen the inside of 12 Grimmauld Place before, and he doesn't say anything. He's thin, too, almost to the point of gauntness, and this should make me feel compassion. Instead, I feel an unexpected anger surge in my heart. I deduce from the conversation around us that he was found with Jenny, but it doesn't mean he can be trusted, especially not him, someone whose father is responsible for the deaths of so many people I loved, someone I never once saw show the least compassion toward another human being, someone who called me mudblood with hatred and unapologetic loathing dripping from his lips. I hate Draco Malfoy, I realize. As much as I can hate someone as insignificant as he is, I hate him. In the grand scheme of things, he is nothing and no one, but I hate him for every spiteful comment, every moment of bullying, every cowardly act, and every bit of snobbery, pretentiousness, and malice he ever inflicted on someone else. He doesn't deserve our kindness or our trust. What he deserves is a place by his father's side, but apparently he hasn't lived up to even those expectations. I stay with Jenny when they are led to the kitchens for a hot meal. She picks at her food under her mother's worried gaze while Malfoy inhales his like it's his last meal on earth. I think about warning him to eat slowly, but something keeps me quiet. He wouldn't listen to me anyway, but I know that isn't the reason I don't say anything. Jenny watches him eat while her fork makes motions on her plate, though it's rarely lifted to her mouth. Her mother tries to engage her in conversation, but Jenny doesn't look at us. I can't decipher her expression as she watches Malfoy, but it makes me wonder what they've been through. I can't imagine being trapped in a room with him for so long, with no relief from his company except for bouts of torture from her captives. The hot tears I feel sting my eyes are for my friend, and I want her to look at me so I can offer her my sympathy. But she doesn't look away from the boy on the other side of the table. How long has it been? I'm so startled by Jenny's finally spoken that I forgot to answer. I haven't heard her voice in a long time, but I know it wasn't this small thing that disappeared in the air like traces of smoke. It's only when the silence stretches unnaturally long that I notice Mrs. Weasley has turned her face to the side, crying quietly so her daughter won't see. 7 months, I answer, finally. Jenny doesn't seem to have noticed the pause and creates one of her own before she murmurs, "It feels a lot longer." I imagine it does. Mrs. Weasley gets herself under control, and she notices how Malfoy is shoveling his food into his mouth as a stoker might shovel coal into a boiler. "Dear, you mustn't eat so quickly. Your body isn't accustomed to..." But it's too late. Malfoy drops his fork and is sick all over the table. Out of instinct, I recoil and push my chair away. I can see out of the corner of my eye that Mrs. Weasley has done the same thing, although she recovers quickly and makes sympathetic sounds as she uses her wand to clean up the mess. Some of it is on his face and on his clothes. I am amazed that Draco Malfoy let himself be sick, and in front of an audience, no less. I can't look away, curious as to what his reaction will be. I hate myself a little for that. He doesn't look at any of us. I take out my wand and help Mrs. Weasley clean up, and when we're done, I notice that Jenny hasn't moved a single muscle, still staring straight ahead. And she might just be a doll sitting there, except for the tears, one after the other, that silently roll down her cheeks. During my Hogwarts days, I never had any trouble falling asleep. In fact, it was somewhat of a joke amongst my dorm mates. If you want Weasley to shut up, just put a pillow next to his head and he'll be unconscious in a heartbeat. But this war has taken more from us than we ever expected, and now sleep eludes me most nights. Earlier, the decision was made to put Malfoy up for the night in a small attachment next to the kitchen, where the night-duty house elf lived when the Blacks were still in residence. After some consultation, we decided to charm the lockup so it could only be opened from the outside. I wasn't the only one who thought we needed to be cautious about him, at least until we could corroborate his story. Malfoy might have had a truce with my sister while in captivity, but that was circumstance that he might have had a hand in manipulating. After all, he probably learned deception before he learned to walk. I expected him to complain about the room, but he surprised me by staying silent. He's either acting docile to get us to lower our defenses, or he knows it's exactly what he deserves. He began to undress perfunctorily, and a sound threatened to escape my throat at the sight of what I had missed before, so focused had I been on Jenny. Thin lines crisscrossed the skin of his arms, his back, his chest. They were innumerable. Most were white and healed, but some were red and looked painful. They didn't seem to bother him as he drew on a pair of cotton trousers Mum had dug out from somewhere. They were too big for his thin frame, and he pulled the drawstrings tightly around his waist in an effort to make them fit. He climbed into the single bed and turned his head away. After I had doused the candles and closed the door behind me, I ran to the nearest toilet where I dry-heaved for several minutes. It was more than seeing the evidence of what they'd done to Malfoy. It was the idea that the same marks of abuse might also adorn my sister's skin. When we were younger, Jenny and I spent a lot of time playing together. More often than not, I was a brave and daring auror, and I'd borrow my father's wand to use as a prop when he was immersed in a new muggle device. Sometimes the twins would play with us, but usually it was just me and Jenny, and I preferred it that way. When it was just the two of us, I was the eldest and made the decisions. When she complained that she wanted to be the hero once in a while, I explained that I had to be the hero and she had to be the person I rescued from the evil dark magicians and other forms of harm because that was the responsibility of big brothers. Jenny always capitulated at this point, and the time that I thought it was because she understood the logic of my reasoning. Now I know different. She'd been right behind me at the time she'd been taken, or so I had thought. I've relived that moment over and over again and saved her 1,000 times, but never when it mattered. I had once told my sister that I would protect her because that's what I was there for. I'd been lying, but I hadn't known it then. She had, though. I know because of the total lack of recrimination in her eyes when we found her. I'd have given anything for her to have hit me or cursed me or shouted, "Ron, you promised! You promised to keep me safe, and you didn't!" Instead, she looked at me without blame, because she had never expected me to keep that promise in the first place. The knowledge is like tiny splinters of glass in my blood, traveling in my veins and cutting me to ribbons from the inside. It doesn't help that the waif who returned to us barely resembles the sister I'd lost. They took a girl so full of life that it bubbled out of her in run-on sentences that tripped over each other because she couldn't get them out fast enough. They took her words and her smile and made a specter of who she used to be. And I don't know if that girl will ever come back. And they made a liar out of me. I want to tell her that I'm sorry, but I'm afraid the words will stick in my throat. I want to ask her what happened during the months she's been gone, but I'm afraid of the answer. I want her to ask me to do something for her, anything, but I'm afraid I won't be able to follow through. But I can hold her hand and let her know that if she needs me, I'm here, and those aren't things she's ever had to ask for. Hermione's room is dark, but the light from the hallway helps me navigate. Jenny's bed is empty, and I tell myself to stay calm as I gently shake Hermione awake. "Ron?" Her voice is groggy. "What is it?" "I'm looking for Jenny," I whisper. "Do you know where she is?"
"Isn't she in bed?"
Hermione wears sleepy confusion well.
"She said she couldn't sleep and was going to get a glass of water."
And of course, Jenny's whereabouts are no longer a mystery. "All right," I say. "Sorry to wake you. Go back to sleep." Concern still etches her face.
"I'll help you look."
"No, don't worry." Hermione closes her eyes and lets out a small sigh, sleep folding her in its arms again. Down the stairs and through the dining hall, the solid walls and thick carpeting masks my solitary journey. Here the rooms are warmer. The heat from the stoves creates a haven during chilly nights. Then my destination is upon me, and I'm not sure why I'm here. My hand is turning the knob before I can decide, and it's only when I can see two sleepers illuminated by a single lit candle that I know. Seeing them, I am assured that through all the dark nights, she had someone. It doesn't matter how or why he was there. Not if he helped her feel even 1 second less alone. And that brings me comfort. When I left Malfoy, he'd been on his back, turned to the opposite wall, but now he's on his stomach, arms outstretched, and I can see his face unguarded in sleep. My sister drapes him like a haphazard blanket. In sleep, she looks almost like the girl I once knew. And the long tresses she once defended from our mother's shears trail over Malfoy's shoulder. Her left arm covers his, and in this light, her skin looks soft and flawless. In this light, they aren't scarred at all.
Always Mine by Angel C. 585. She sat, practically cowering before him, and he'd never felt so heady. Her red head was bowed, wrists and ankles chafed, and he knew that all Botticelli's enchanted artwork, forever hidden from the Muggle Philistines, couldn't compare with her chained beauty. Yet, it wasn't simply her exquisite face, her lustrous hair, or her graceful curves that moved the cynical poet within him. It was seeing it all bound before him, bent to any of his dark whims, and the slow death of the fire in her eyes that stirred his shadowed soul. He leant down to his prize, the little treat he'd awarded himself for surpassing his personal Muggle torturing quota for the week, and yanked the ties from the plaits on either side of her head, roughly pulling his fingers through the blazing tresses he'd spied in too many corridors that he'd yearned to touch from afar. The fingers of his right hand still twisted in her hair, he brought his left up to caress, however barely, her freckle-dusted neck, knowing that his touch would shame her more than the flimsiness of what had once been her school uniform. The rats in the manor dungeon, he was pleased to see, had done away with almost half of her pleated skirt in the months that she'd been there. Been his. He didn't always have her brought up to his rooms, but satisfied with having made it through a particularly grueling week of a hidden war of manipulation, he felt he'd earned some fun. He fancied he could feel the disgust emanating from her in waves, but whether it was directed inwardly or at him, he neither knew nor cared. As long as she felt it, felt something so passionately that was not concerned with her family, or Potter, or anyone other than him, the black hole somewhere within him was temporarily sated. But tonight, the deep void that devoured what had once been a beautiful boy demanded more, and he grasped the chain that ran from the iron ring round her neck to the one connecting her wrists and tugged sharply upwards. The choked gasp she gave was music to his ears, and as she stumbled to her feet, he allowed himself a wicked smirk. He restrained himself from dragging her bodily towards the four-poster, instead leading her gently in a cruel contrast of what was to come. Apart from an open-handed slap or two the night Crab had brought the newly captured Weasley to the manor, Draco had followed the etiquette drilled into him by his mother. Gentlemen didn't hit ladies. It simply wasn't done. His father before him had been a gentleman, and it was from him that Draco had learned that, as in all things, there were certain actions, or circumstances, that fell outside the rules. Certain acts, his father's example had shown, were fully excusable, perhaps even encouraged. And it was on such a firm foundation of morals, however dubious, that Draco Malfoy operated. Her fear of both pain and the unknown was almost palpable as he slid a link in the wrist chain onto a hook fastened to his bedpost, which closed into a ring at a muttered incantation. His captive plaything trembled slightly, affecting Draco more than he would admit aloud. He reached around her, trapping her in a circle of his arms for a moment, before tearing open what was left of her school's shirt. She tried to muffle a gasp, which could only been from shock, humiliation, or maybe just the cold. And he smirked again as he made his way to the Tasmanian oak chest of drawers, removing his newest toy from the bottom drawer. His mind had immediately jumped to Little Jinny, as he mockingly thought of her, when he'd seen the glorious enchanted cat-o'-nine tails in the shop window in Nocturne Alley. He returned to stand behind her, and very nearly laughed at the obvious difference in height. Her head didn't even come up to his collarbone. Gently, he brushed the tails of the whip over her slightly freckled back, smiling again as a lip was bitten and deep brown eyes squeezed shut in fearful anticipation. Stepping back, he brought the cat down in a fierce lash, rewarded by a pained gasp and nine brilliant scarlet lines. Usually, when women arched their back in his presence, it was in pleasure, and Draco allowed himself the thought that maybe she was enjoying this, being here, being his. He knelt and ran his hot tongue over the marks, licking away her blood, trailing up her neck to the base of her red, red hair. "Did we enjoy that, Little Jinny?" he whispered against her neck. "Are you still Potter's brave Gryffindor lion? Or are you becoming the scared little kitten I know hides inside? The one you hid after precious Tom nearly drowned it in darkness?" When she didn't rise to the verbal barb, he brought the physical ones down across her back again, changing the angle to create a crisscross pattern that the aesthetic in him rather enjoyed. He was rewarded with a slight whimper, and even better, a salty tear which his tongue caught halfway down her neck, following its trail up to the corner of her closed eye. "That's it, kitten," he whispered, enjoying and amused by her wordless discomfort. "Cry for me. Tell me it hurts. Beg me to stop. Tell the big bad Death Eater how horrid he is, how he shames you so. How there's nothing you want more than to be free of me." Despite her best efforts, the pain and humiliation, the fear at his voice caused her to shake, and the fact that he affected her so thrilled him. A black flame within him flared up, and he caressed the iron cuff around her neck, which tightened at his muttering. Her breathing was reduced to nervous, shallow gasps, and almost without thinking, he brought the whip down for a third strike. Finally, a reaction, a whimper, and he loosened the neck cuff in reward. She tried to sag against the post in relief, but a fist thrust into her hair pulled her violently back, prevented even a moment's comfort. He kept his fist tightly wound in her hair and slowly pulled her head around to face him, kissed her with open eyes so he could exult in the fear written all over her face. In the face of his cruelty and deprivation, her eyes lost focus. Her mind slipped back to haunting memories, and she whispered soundlessly against his lips. He bent, his ear next to her mouth, and caught the words she all but breathed out. "Worse, worse than my Tom, my Tom." Triumphant, he forcefully released her hair so that the momentum caused her to stagger into his chest. He freed the chain from the post, encircled her arms with his own, and crushed her to him. "Your Tom, my Jenny," he whispered. He pulled her to the floor with him, and she yielded, still recovering from her mental lapse. Laying her on the soft green carpet, he bent over her to press her still joined hands above her head and placed his lips on her ear. "Always mine." Scream by Pipperstorms. "Oh, Merlin, it hurts. Everything hurts. I can't even see straight. Oh, hell, forget seeing. I can't think straight. All I know is that we're all going to die. We're all going to die, and it's going to be ridiculously painful. I shouldn't have to die like this. No one my age should have to die like this. Yet here we all are, fighting for our lives and losing. But no, somehow I don't regret that I'm not on the losing side. I really should regret it. I should be ashamed of my treasonous acts, but I'm not. For once in my life, I know I'm doing the right thing. If I wasn't here dying tonight, I'd be killed in the morning. At least now I'm not dying like a coward. Let that be known, despite my horrendous reputation. I am not a coward. I try standing up, and quite frankly, I'm surprised my legs still work after being on the receiving end of so many curses. At least 2 cruciatus curses came my way, which could be why my head hurts so much. But doesn't matter much that my head hurts. I can't very well ask the person currently firing at me to stop on account of that, now can I? No, I thought not, as it seems unlikely for them to stop unless I do them some serious harm. Maybe if I burn his skin off, he'll leave me alone. Doubtful. They're a stubborn lot. Oh, not again. Whatever they just fired at me hurts far too much to be good for me. I have to do something about this, fast, if possible. Even I know I'm not supposed to bleed this much. I have no idea what curse I just used, but apparently it worked. My attacker is on the ground, withering in pain. Actually, now that I've gotten a look at his face, I'm pretty sure I knew him once. It's a shame, really. I think I might have killed him. Again, I know I should feel guilty, but I can't bring myself to. I can't really bring myself to feel anything right now, except maybe pain, which has only gotten worse as I've kept moving. I can't convince myself to stop, though. I know it would be so easy to just lie down and die, because I know I'm going to die from what they've done to me. But I can't let myself go. Not just yet. There's someone I still have to find. I need to know if she's okay. If I still can, I need to get her out of here. She's too good and pure to die like this. I fought for her for at least an hour before, trying to convince her not to come, but she's stubborn too. More stubborn than I am, perhaps. But we'll see. In truth, I just want to see her again before the inevitable happens. I'd call out for her if I thought it would help, but I don't. That would only attract more attention. Attention that neither one of us can afford right now. Bad attention. and any type of normal day setting, she isn't too hard to find. The flaming red hair is something of a dead giveaway. But here, on this dark battlefield, everything is tinted red. This is pointless. The rational part of me is trying to reason with that other half of me, the half that thinks I'm in love. The part of me that is most certainly not rational. If there's just one thing I've learned from her, it is that people do irrational things when they're in love. I never should have let her out of my sight. But being a traitor, I tend to attract that unwanted attention, and I didn't want her to have any part of that. Ah, there it is. Her voice is unmistakable. I can hear her shouting out a curse from a good distance away. I keep following that sound, taking as many of the enemy down as I can. The less of them there are, the higher my chances of survival. No, let me correct that statement. The greater chances of her survival. As I've already said, I know I'm going to die. And really, what's the point in lying to oneself? She's seen me, I can tell. She's fighting faster now, working her way towards me, as I am towards her. She doesn't look too bad off. A few scrapes here and bruises there. From what I can see, if she leaves now, she'll live. It's doubtful she'll listen to me when I tell her to run. That damned Gryffindor bravery. It makes them all do stupid things, if you ask me. Oh, fuck! It's another Cruciatus curse, this one worse than the others. I vaguely wonder who it is throwing this one and what grievance I have committed towards him to make him despise me so. But the pain is too much to think very coherently. The next thing I know, I'm twitching on the ground. The curse has been lifted, but it doesn't do much to ease the pain. I can hear her screaming too. Oh, Merlin, that hurts worse than all the Cruciatus curses I've endured so far tonight combined. I have to make it stop. I will not allow the last sound I hear to be her screaming. My attacker must have switched to her. Even he was bright enough to know that I'm not going to last much longer. Why should he waste his time on those already damned? I lunge forward with all the strength I have left. It's just enough to accomplish my goal. I broke the line of contact for a spell. He can't get to her with my arms around her. No, he's forced to focus on me instead. Frankly, I don't care. I don't think he cares who he's hurting. All I know is she couldn't scream while I held her close. I swore I'd never let her go. Even if I die here, taking this curse in her stead, I'll die a happy man. She's shaking in my arms. I can almost taste her fear above my pain. Almost. She's afraid I'm going to die. She doesn't want to lose me. But what can I do? It's either her or me, and he'll make sure I die anyway. I can tell she's trying to tell me something, but I can't hear her above the screaming in my head. I won't open my mouth. I won't give the blonde man hiding behind a Death Eater's mask the pleasure of hearing me scream. I know that would get him off. It's always been one of his favourite sounds. The sick bastard. He's killing his own son, and his only regret is that I won't scream for him. I can tell just by the look in his eyes. There's disappointment there, but if it's for the way I turned out, or for the fact that I'm defending a blood traitor, I'll never know. He's going to kill me, and I don't plan on meeting up with him once I pass beyond the veil. He's one of the last people I'll miss when I die. The person I will miss, maybe the only one, is still holding on to me. Very tightly, I might add. She's just adding to the pain, but I'll let her. She's too scared to know, but as long as my arms are around her, I know she won't be screaming. She won't be screaming as long as I'm taking her pain, but she is crying.
I can feel the warmth of her tears against my chest, through the rips in my shirt. I wish I could make those stop too. That'll be my regret for dying, that I couldn't make this painless for her. My death is going to hurt her. Her tears are the proof. My vision is starting to tunnel in. I can hardly keep my eyes open, but I want the last thing I see to be her. Maybe if I focus enough on her face, I can make some of the pain go away.
Alas, my father is growing impatient. He's working harder to bring my death faster. He always did get bored easily.
She's still whispering to me, "Oh, my poor, sweet, red-haired goddess." She's telling me to hold on for her. I want to. Morgana knows I want to. I want to have the life we planned together. I was going to ask her to marry me next week. It was going to be our first year anniversary. I know that's not a long time, but with the war, lives have ended sooner. Truth be told, the ring is actually in my pocket. But I'll never get the chance to ask her for her hand. I was even going to ask permission of her father and eldest brother first. It was going to be perfect. Everything was going to be perfect. It was going to be everything this beautiful angel deserved. But instead, it's this. And I never deserved her. She keeps telling me she loves me over and over again. It's like she thinks that if she says it enough, it'll save me. But I'm afraid it isn't that simple. Nothing ever is. She's making promises to different gods in exchange for my life. It's not doing any good. I can feel my life slipping through my fingers. But I still want to fight this, if only to answer her wishes. It's almost sad. Here I am dying, and my only desire is still to make her happy. Love really does make you think and act irrationally. I slip my hand into my pocket. I want her to know how much I love her, how much I always will. I want her to have the ring. Somehow, I manage to slide it into her hand. She's crying harder now, telling me not to leave her, telling me she'll always hate me for leaving her like this. But I know she won't. I don't think she's capable of hate. She loved me, after all. This is the end. I only have a few seconds left, maybe less. I tilt my head towards her ear and kiss her as best I can. I whisper that I love her, and I swear to her that even in death, I always will. I swore to her, I swore I'd never let her go. But of course it would be too kind to have one of my last wishes answered. And in my last seconds of life, I can hear her scream. It's a scream of anger at my father, and hurt for the hole in her heart, and regret for all the things that she'll never get to say to me. It's a sound heard far too frequently these days. The scream of those left behind. The scream of the broken-hearted.
Just Call Me Lucifer by Angel C. 585. The connoisseur in him had decided that there was nothing in this world more beautiful than the contrast of harsh purple bruises against her pale porcelain skin. Careful consideration had led him to the conclusion that he rather fancied the daisy chain of marks around her neck the best in his extensive repertoire. Thinking on them for long enough would make his head spin even more than the sight of huge, still shocked brown eyes when she would find herself trapped between his powerful body and the nearest substantial vertical surface. Bookcases, walls, doors, even his late mother's trellis arch in the rose garden had been sites for various pouncings when he would make his mark on her body, even while showing her how intoxicated he was by it. In the beginning, she had fought him tooth and nail, the utter futility of it rendering him amused as well as aroused.
Slowly, though, logic had won out, and he had been disappointed to see the resignation in her eyes as she dully accepted that any strength within her 5'3" frame was simply no match against a man who could have easily rivaled her brother Bill for height and musculature. It was at this perilous point that he decided provocation was the better part of amusement. He would force her to fight back at him and catalog each episode in his mind, sorting and rating them, reliving his favorites through a pensive until he found himself a connoisseur of her fiery temper as well. She was, he decided, his very favorite toy. When he'd first brought her home, he'd been almost overwhelmed by the possibilities her presence offered. She'd come to him a blank canvas, though he'd laid his designs down on her body soon enough. While the essential elements of her personality were there, the temper, the flair of courage, the occasional defiance, and the secret damage of a handsome brunette boy that she'd hidden away, but which undermined all her Gryffindor bravado, it was Draco's delight, his privilege, to work them like clay, pushing, molding, pinching, and kneading until he formed a work of art that was truly spellbinding. And best of all, she wasn't the static marble of the sculptures his mother had so loved. She was fluid, always changing, reacting, her body awakening under his touch, as her mind would rise and fall out of conscious rebellion and submission like storm-tossed waves. The pleasure he found reminiscing over the stone basin gave rise to a new idea of how best he could enjoy and anticipate the discomfort that thrilled him so. After all, he was a man of wealth and taste. He'd heard tell, whispers in dark corners of unsavory parties his parents would always attend but never mention, of the perfect place to expand the horizons of her horror. He'd pored over every inch of the library until he'd found it in a slim, leather-bound volume with neither title nor markings save the odd triangular design embossed on the front. The reverse oubliette, the antithesis of the original oubliette, which had served as a place things were put to forget them, this world, with the right adjustments, function instead to force the occupant to relive their moments of greatest terror. He threw himself into researching and experimenting, crafting the perfect prison that would require her mind to truly hold her. Even so, he was careful to never let his attention to this pursuit supersede his other study. He'd turned the testing of her emotional and physical pain threshold into a veritable art form. Every time she uttered a new whimper, tried to find a new way to stay the onslaught of his hands, his lips, his teeth, he'd delight in the ever-widening array of reactions he'd spurred her to. Her wide brown eyes greeted him as he beheld her, victorious both in his completion of her new home and in his search for the object of his depraved obsession. With practiced ease, he gripped her upper arm over newly formed bruises, flowers of yellow and purple that to his mind were more beautiful than any of the blooms in the manor gardens. She was hauled along down wide hallways and through luxuriously appointed rooms, the opulence of which did nothing to endear them to her. Too many memories held memories of anguish and fear, dark corners of sharp pain. Eventually, he had brought his quarry to his latest achievement, a work second only to her transformation. He waved his wand, it had been so long since she'd held one, at the locks which had materialized on either side of the door, which proceeded to swing open. Before steering her inside, he placed his lips next to her ear and whispered a few parting words before leaving her to her memories. No one's charging in on a firebolt to rescue you, Jenny. Welcome to your happily never after. Something in the phrase, both vaguely familiar and long forgotten, stirred her as she turned to his too close face and whispered a question he'd only ever answered with his actions, not his words. Why? Why are you doing this to me? After all I've made you, you still have to ask. Really?
Some of us don't have the luxury of naivete, Ginevra. You're more beautiful this way. I've made you more beautiful. You were always a work of art that only I truly appreciated, and I've molded you to my tastes. You were too young for Tom to appreciate, and precious Harry was too blind. I alone saw your potential, and I alone will see your perfection fulfilled. With that parting salvo, the door was shut. He'd waited almost a week for the effects of his latest efforts to truly impress on his masterpiece before returning to view his investment. What he saw, perhaps, he would reflect, was the height of her beauty, but he resented it nonetheless. Through the color of the blood puddled around her only enriched her hair and contrasted wonderfully with her markedly paler skin, he couldn't help but feel she'd stolen his fun, wrecked his game, trashed his gallery. He closed the door in disgust. He did so hate broken toys.
If anyone is still listening to the angst fest of bracketed doom, I hope you enjoyed yourself. I did want to remind you that I'm going to start reading audio fix separate from the podcast that will give the long and completed stories a chance to be heard. So if you have any of those you would like to recommend, please do so. I did want to give credit where credit is due. I didn't, but the top 10 reasons you're an angst, you know you're an angst fangirl, was by Marantha Del Bloom. So thanks to her for that. And I will see you all in the happy, happy month of July. Bye-bye.